Hey, Rabbi Shammah, Rabbi Barry, and all of those guests that are present, I admire you that you took off time from a busy week to come to hear about something as arcane as Dead Sea Scrolls. So what I'd like to do is basically to introduce you to the scrolls, and after I do that, to examine and read some scrolls together with you. So by the time we all leave tonight, we will all have read some Dead Sea Scrolls holding the texts in front of us. I'll distribute this a little later. In the early spring of 1947, a Bedouin of the Tamira tribe in Jordan was searching for a stray goat somewhere near the Dead Sea. Thinking that the goat may have wandered into a cave, he threw a stone into the cave in order to have the goat run out. But instead of a goat running out, he heard the shattering sound of broken glass. By chance, he had hit an ancient jar, and he shattered that jar. The jar, of course, contained an ancient scroll, and that was the first of the Dead Sea Scrolls that was discovered. I mention this to you because it's a very sobering thought to consider the fact that the Dead Sea Scrolls, generally considered the greatest archaeological discovery of the 20th century, these scrolls were first discovered by a goat. Now, they were discovered in caves, thank you, on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea, and at a room called Qumran, so they're sometimes referred to as the Qumran Scrolls. And to give you a good sense of what these caves look like, where the scrolls were discovered, here you have a beautiful photograph, and I'll pass this around. This is a periodical called the Biblical Archaeology Review, BAR. It's an older issue, but it's a perfect photograph of the mountains and caves. And these are some of the caves where Dead Sea Scrolls were actually discovered, so you can see what it looks like. Sometimes you have to actually hang from ropes in order to be able to enter into the cave and find scrolls. Qumran, this room where the scrolls were discovered, is about 10 miles east of Jerusalem and some 8 miles south of Jericho. So you have a sense of where it is, and I'm sure many of you who visited Eretz Yisrael probably visited Qumran's site. In all, 11 caves containing Dead Sea Scrolls were ultimately discovered, and the manuscripts that were recovered from these scrolls, from these caves, number over 800. 800 different manuscripts recovered from 11 caves, plus literally tens of thousands of fragments of manuscripts. Tens of thousands of fragments of manuscripts, in some cases part of the 800 that were discovered, in many cases making up other independent scrolls. All of these scrolls are approximately 2,000 years old. It would take the rest of this presentation just to list for you the names of the scrolls that were discovered, so we're not going to do that. Instead of doing that, what I'd like to do is to describe briefly the nature of this ancient library that was discovered at Qumran, and to highlight some of the more important manuscripts that have been recovered. First of all, copies of every book of Tanakh were discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls, except for Megillat Esther. In some instances, many copies of the same book of Tanakh were discovered. Most of the texts are written in a beautiful Hebrew script, which you will be reading shortly, not very unlike, the very script we still use in Sifrei Torah in 1995. Several of the scrolls are written in ancient Hebrew, not the Hebrew that we use today in our Sifrei Torah, but the Hebrew that was used in the time of Malchei Yisrael, Malchei Yehuda, or in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, Ktav Ivri, the old Hebrew script, and some of the Dead Sea Scrolls are written in that old Hebrew script. Copies of various books of the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha in Hebrew were discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls. We use Ashurit, that they once used Ktav Ivri, and some of the Dead Sea Scrolls are written in Ktav Ivri. By Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, I mean books that are not included in Tanakh, but once were by certain groups of Jews. It's even possible that some of our ancestors may have once included some books, like Ben Sirah, if you're familiar with it, is quoted in the Talmud, a beautiful book. Hebrew copies of Ben Sirah were discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I'll pass around one of these volumes. You can look at some of the photographs. These are actually original Hebrew copies. We always had Greek copies. Greek copies are preserved through the ages. The Greek was translated into Latin. The Latin was translated into English. So you can go to any bookstore and get yourself a book called the Apocrypha, and you'll have the Book of Ben Sirah, a beautiful book, not very different from Mishlei, Book of Wisdom. It's available in English, but now they found Hebrew copies from the Talmudic period and so on. Yes, there were. That's right. Absolutely, they found in the Cairo Geniza portions, not the whole book, but portions of the Book of Ben Sirah. And these are different portions. Among the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found some of the portions that had not yet been recovered from the Geniza. Absolutely, and books like the Book of Tobit, the Book of Hanoch, Enoch, are now available in the original Hebrew. We actually have them in the original Hebrew. Targums, that is, Aramaic translations of biblical books, have also been recovered from the Dead Sea Scrolls. In some cases, they're translations of biblical books. In some cases, they're commentaries on biblical books. And these targums are not the same as our Targumim, Targum Unculus, or Targum Yonatan. Different targums from ancient times. These may be the targums, for those of you who know your Talmudic literature, in Sechet Shabbat, Tosefta, there's a ban on certain targums. Both in Babli and in Tosefta, Targum on Iyov was mentioned, and among the Dead Sea Scrolls, a Targum on Iyov was actually recovered. Some strange Midrashim, some in Hebrew, some in Aramaic, many, many interesting documents have been recovered from the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is a Midrash on Sefer Bereshit. Has a very, you're all familiar, of course, with Abraham and Sarah. You may wonder what color hair Sarah had or exactly what she looked like. If you read this scroll that was discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's a vivid physical description of the color of the hair of Sarah and exactly what she looked like. This is a Midrash discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Ancient commentaries on biblical books called Psharim were discovered. Pesher Habakkuk, Pesher Nachum, these are also of great interest to scholars. Now, aside from the biblical materials or biblical-related materials, a host of non-biblical books were discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls in Hebrew and in Aramaic. These are books that are uniquely sectarian, meaning these are books that belong to the people who wrote them. No copies of these books have come down to us through the ages, as it were. These are new books for us. We can read the library of the Jews who belong to what is known as the Dead Sea sect. These books are, in some cases, halachot, rules and regulations, how you become a member of the group. If you join this group, what laws are you to observe above and beyond the laws of the Torah, and so on. Some of these books talk about the history of the sect, their aspirations, their views of Yemot HaMashiach and the end of time, and so on. I'm going to single out two of the more important scrolls for mention at this point, so you should know about them, because you're going to read about them, if you haven't already, in much of the literature that will be published in the next 10 years or so. An incredible scroll that was discovered is called by the scholars who published it, Megillat HaMikdash. Megillat HaMikdash. It is the largest of all the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it is a vivid description of how to build the Beit HaMikdash. It is particularly interesting because it is written in the first person. The author is Hashem, God Himself. And God speaks throughout the scroll and says, and I command you, it doesn't say Vayadaber Hashem el Moshe lemor in the third person, and then you have mitzvot. Hashem is speaking. And Hashem says, this is how you shall construct my Beit HaMikdash. And you shall build the walls this size and that size, and you shall bring the following sacrifices, etc. This is the scroll that no one's ever seen before. in a certain sense, almost no one ever heard of. But just to show you why this is so fascinating to me, first let me show you a photograph of the scroll so you'll get a sense of what this scroll looked like. This is the Megillat HaMikdash, known as the Temple Scroll. This is what it looked like when it was discovered and opened for the first time. Now you can see it looks like a Sefer Torah. Almost intact. You can see a mouse or some other animal got a good part of the top, but the rest of it is intact. We'll pass this around so you can see what the... this is Megillah. This is actually a photograph of Megillat HaMikdash. Now, just to show you the kind of gems we have in rabbinic literature. First, in Sefer Divrei Hayamim, in our Hebrew Bible, Sefer Divrei Hayamim, this is 1 Chronicles 28:19. We have a verse that reads, describes how the Beit HaMikdash was built by David HaMelech and by Shlomo. And it says it was built according to instructions, Hakol Bichtav Miyad Hashem. It was written from the writing, Miyad Hashem. Alai Hiskil Kol Malachot HaTavnit. So David tells to Shlomo, he gives him instructions how to build the Beit HaMikdash. He says, make sure you build it all according to Hakol Bichtav Miyad Hashem. Which letter is this? What is it? It doesn't say Minat Torah. It says Mikhtav Miyad Hashem. I'm holding here a copy of a Midrash, one of the many Midrashim that our rabbis preserved for us. This is called Midrash Shmuel. On that verse, it chronicles Rabbi Yirmiyah b'shem Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yitzchak Megillat Beit HaMikdash. There was a Megillah called Megillat Beit HaMikdash, and that's what David HaMelech gave to Shlomo. Here's in the Midrash. It's unbelievable. Oh, it's older than I am. Very old. I can't put a date on it, but before the 10th century. This is Midrash Shmuel. This is a Midrash of the Chachamim on Sefer Shmuel. It's post-Talmudic, which means it's after the 5th century, somewhere between the 5th and 10th century. But here's a reference to a Megillat Beit HaMikdash. That's what it's actually called here in the Midrash. With all sorts of psukim to prove that there is such a Megillat HaMikdash, the most obvious one being in Divrei HaYamim. Yes.
And also, is that indication that it was written after the
Korban
or after?
You have to be very careful. You're asking too many questions. I'll try to address it a little later. All right, I'll come back when I start talking about the group themselves. You see, yes, but the immediate answer is yes. The Beit HaMikdash that's described in this scroll is not the same as what we know, or what either Hurdus built, or what's described either in the Mishkan or in the it's different. First of all, the Mikdash in Yecheskel is different than the Mikdash of the Mishkan, and so there are differences between the different accounts of the Mikdash. Good question. I'll talk about it. Okay. But I'm only mentioning at this point that Chazal had a Mesorah that there was a Megillat Beit HaMikdash, and believe it or not, unbelievable, Dead Sea Scrolls, they find an incredible scroll that no one's ever seen before, and it's Megillat HaMikdash.
Okay. How do we get a Midrash? Like, how do we know that it's post-Talmudic?
We have very good ways, but the simplest way that one knows is if the Midrash contains many, many texts and names of Rabbanim and so on that are never mentioned in the Talmud. You can assume it's post-Talmudic. Right? That's how we know. You saw some of these scrolls, absolutely. I don't know which ones you saw, but some of the Dead Sea Scrolls are on display in that famous museum. Absolutely. That's right. That's right. Now, another very important scroll has just been published, so I bring it to your attention. This is it was just published by Oxford University Press. This is called Miktzat Maasei Torah. There are going to be books and articles written for the next 25 years at least, just on this book that I'm holding. These are the official publications of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is an incredible volume. This is a Sefer Halakha that was discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And very briefly, it appears to be It appears to be a letter from the leader of the Dead Sea sect, could be a Kohen Gadol, the leader of the Dead Sea sect, to the Chachamim, to our Rabbanim, to the leader of the Jews that we know, us, our ancestors, listing all the differences between this group of Jews, how they worship, and how they observe the Torah and Mitzvot, and what we do. And everything that in this letter it says, you do this, but we do that. Whenever it says, you do this, it's exactly what we have in Mishnayot and in the Talmud. So this is very, very interesting. And now we have firsthand what another group of Jews was practicing in Eretz Yisrael at the same time that Chazal were there. It's available in some bookstores. Not in any bookstore, but in a... I'll be happy to tell you where you can get it afterwards. Okay. I'll pass this around. Can you please handle with care? Yes. Is there... No, this has nothing to do immediately with Otoai. This is pre-Christian. Pre-Christian. Good question. We'll talk about it, but nothing to do with Christianity. I'm sorry.
Do you still recognize that the Dead Sea sect is schizophrenic? They're not, amongst the three groupings of the 15, 15, what you see?
They may well be. I'll talk about it. I'll come to that a little later.
Right? The newspaper article says that it might threaten the authenticity of
Christianity. I'll talk about it. Give me a chance and I'll get to it. Yes.
Regarding, I have to be here all night.
regarding MMT.
Right.
And the parallel between the Shema and the typical dynamic dimension and the differences between the Shema and the MMT. I know that such a statement is very apt to show creates this link between the Kiddushin and the rabbis of the Mishnah, this 400-year link, and to show that this legitimizes all of the rabbinic literature in the Mishnah. How does he, in your opinion, is it going too far, or how legitimate is his claim?
Well, he says much more than you summarized in two short sentences, obviously. That there is a relationship between the Perushim and Chazal is clear, obvious, was known before the Dead Sea Scrolls. The other side of the equation, which Professor Schiffman is the one who's pushing for more than anybody else, that the Dead Sea sect are in fact the Tzedukim. Mm-hmm. That is less clear, much less clear. So to answer you immediately, the first part, the equation of Perushim and Chazal, I have no problem with. The second part, that the Dead Sea sect were in fact the Tzedukim described in the Gemara, I find that very difficult for a variety of reasons. But let me move on and I'll get to it. Go ahead.
Is MMT, isn't it said like that for that,
yeah,
the conclusive proof to what? In other words, is his conclusion from MMT the conclusive proof that it claims it to be?
Well, it can't be, because the Dead Sea Scrolls are more than MMT. The Dead Sea Scrolls are all the Dead Sea Scrolls. And whatever you're going to say about the sect, you have to read all their books and see what they... When you read all their books, it's very clear they're not just the Tzadukim. They may be related to the Tzadukim, and we'll talk about it, but they're not the equivalent of Chazal's Tzadukim. This can be proved... Anyone who knows Gemara and anyone who knows Halakha can prove this immediately. That is, whatever presumably Chazal knew about the Tzadukim that they're talking about, when Chazal record in Masechet Menachot and elsewhere the teachings of the Tzadukim, many of those teachings are not in harmony with the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Dead Sea sect, as I will claim a little later if I get there, is related to the Tzadukim, but not equal to the Tzadukim mentioned in the Gemara. Very good. Maybe, could be. All candidates for the Dead Sea sect. All very good. All possibilities. All possibilities. May well be. Absolutely. Needs to be investigated. That's why I said many books are going to be written. All possibilities. These people were Tovlei Shacharit, more than Tovlei, they were Tovlei Mincha and Mariv also. These people went to the mikveh all the time. So they may be the Tovlei Shacharit. Could be. Right. Yeah, well, it makes sense. Look, the evidence is not all the evidence is in, Not all the evidence has been published. There's room here for much differences of opinion. Yeah, we'll give it a try. Okay. Now, after the 11 caves were examined and various scrolls recovered, of course, archaeologists then, and Bedouin as well, went searching throughout the Judean desert, throughout Midbar Yehuda. They found many more scrolls, many more documents. So in the broader term, when one speaks of the Dead Sea Scroll discoveries, one means not just what was found in the 11 caves, but what was found at Mitzada and many other related places from the same time period. That includes Bar Kokhba letters and all sorts of other interesting things. So all this is included usually in discussions of the Dead Sea sect, Dead Sea Scrolls, Dead Sea materials. Now, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, so I just want to focus for a minute on the controversy that you read about in the New York Times and elsewhere, so we'll have a little handle on that, and then I'm going to move to the text that I would like to read with you. When they were discovered, an international team of some 10 to 20 scholars was appointed immediately by the Jordanian authorities. Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered at Qumran at that time, 1947, so on, and afterwards it belonged to Jordan. So the Jordanian authorities created a team of scholars who were assigned the scrolls, and it was their task to publish them. No Jews were allowed to read or to publish Dead Sea Scrolls. The international team consisted entirely of non-Jews. It was announced that a definitive edition of the scrolls would be published by the Oxford University Press, volume by volume, until all the Dead Sea Scrolls would appear in print, and it was estimated at that time that it would take 25 volumes to publish the entire set of scrolls. From 1947, when the scrolls were discovered, until, let's say, some 40 years later, until 1990, 8 volumes of Dead Sea Scrolls were published. 8 volumes like the Green Volume, if it's still circulating. They all look like that. Pretty much the same size. 8 volumes were published in over 40 years. Over 40 years, 8 volumes were published. This has been described as the academic scandal of the century. That is, that this great discovery was made, which relates to the history of Christianity and the history of Judaism and the history of the Bible. Very important texts. Scholars, 15 scholars are working on this material. It was all divided among the 15 or so scholars, and the best they could do in 40 years. 40 years. You just told me you published how many volumes? 15. How many years was that?
21.
Okay. But 15 and 21. 40 years. Okay. 40 years. They could publish 8 volumes. Yeah, I'll talk about it. Yeah, we'll see what happens. Okay. Now, I know this is being recorded, but I hope no one will print what I'm going to tell you now. Of course, it's no great secret to understand what happened here and why they could only publish 8 volumes in 40 years. These texts are written largely in Lashon Chazal. They're written in Aramaic, many of them, or in Hebrew mixed with Aramaic. They come from the period of Chazal, or shortly before Chazal, 2000 B.C. Many of them are written in good Mishnaic Hebrew, like Mitzat Masei Torah. They were assigned to Goyim. They were assigned to 15 Christian scholars, never read a Talmudic passage in their lives. The miracle is they published 8 volumes. So it's no, it's not difficult to understand. The people who could have published those volumes, there were great Talmudists alive, great Rabbanim and great scholars. They were not allowed access to this material. So it's not a great surprise why these scrolls weren't published. And no, it's changed. I'll tell you another story, which you won't find in print. One of the great early scholars, Lichvodo, I won't mention his name, great early scholars, one of these 15 scholars who was assigned the scrolls, once said this, and I was present and heard this. He said, "I'll never forget. how when they were first investigating the scrolls, as soon as they were discovered, and they opening up each one of these scrolls and trying to, very hard to identify them, but very often they just had a few lines or a column and so on. He says, I'll never forget, he was standing with another fellow and they were looking at a scroll that they just discovered, and he was reading it. He had a hard time, but he was able to figure out, and he puzzled out the first word on the top of a column. It said Chazon. And he couldn't figure out the next word, but it looked like a yud. And it looked like a shin, but he had no idea what it was, but it looked like a yud and a shin. So he took a concordance, and he looked up Chazon, and he figured out that it was Yeshayahu. Now you understand why they published 8 volumes in 40 years. The last decade or so, an enterprising Jew by the name of Herschel Shanks, not a scholar, but an editor of magazines, started to publish a magazine, which already circulated one of them, and here's a fairly recent issue. I'll pass around another one so you can look at it. It's a marvelous periodical called Biblical Archaeology Review.
If you have any of the back copies, transcripts
on the university library. Wonderful. Right here in Stark Center. Okay, good. And yes. He decided to undertake the cause of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he is well connected with the New York Times. And he led a crusade over the last 10 years or so, a crusade, which made him many enemies. But it was a crusade to get the Dead Sea Scrolls reassigned to Jews and to get the Dead Sea Scrolls published. And by a miracle, he succeeded. For many years, he failed. You learn from him the importance of perseverance. Never give up. Year after year, he would publish article after article, letter to the editors of the New York Times, everywhere describing this scandal. And he was put down by the establishment. The scholars had no use for him and so on, criticized him. He never gave up. And then with the help of a minor miracle, it could be Yad Hashem was involved here, I don't know, but a minor miracle helped him in a way that he could never have predicted himself. But having fought this battle over many years without success, but at least he publicized it so everybody knew about it, it turned out that, I think it was about 1988 or so, a few years ago, it turned out that the scholars in Israel and Jordan, and of course you know in the 67 war, so Qumran, not only Qumran, but more importantly, what's called East Jerusalem, Yerushalayim Hashlema, fell into the hands of the Jews, the Israelis. All the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were kept in the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem, now are in Israeli hands. That's why you saw many of them in a scrollery in an Israel museum. So Israel now had access to the scrolls. And if Israel wanted to, the government had wanted to at that time, they could have published all the scrolls, or they could have reassigned all the scrolls to Jews. Israel refused to do this. And kol hakavod to Israel. Israel wanted to honor the original team that was assigned the scrolls. And these were, some of them were great scholars. Father Milik, if you heard of him, Ped Milik and others. It wasn't proper quiet to take these scrolls away. And we Jews have enough, there are enough anti-Semites in the world, we don't have to create more anti-Semites. So the Israeli government decided that whoever was assigned these scrolls can keep them and let them publish the scrolls. But Israel would try through a variety of methods to see to it that they came out a little sooner. And some scrolls at that time were assigned to Jews. Scrolls that hadn't been assigned yet were assigned to some Jews. But this still went at a snail's pace. Nothing was really resolved. And Shanks kept pounding away until about 1988, when the following happened. And if you were reading the New York Times this past week or so, you would have read about it again, because the man who was responsible for the publication of the scrolls just died. And there was an obituary on him in the Times. What happened was... No. A librarian in California. He also died this week. What happened was as follows. Israel knew full well that, as well as the Jordanians, the scrolls were kept either in the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem, or other scrolls that were discovered were kept in the Israel Museum and also it's somewhere kept actually at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Everyone knew that this is very vulnerable, that the worst place to keep valuable scrolls is anywhere in the Near East, and certainly not in Jerusalem. War could break out at any moment. Missiles could start falling from the sky. And here we have the most valuable documents in the world. This was no place to keep, to store valuable documents. So very early on, both Israel and Jordan agreed that they would secretly photograph all the scrolls. And they would deposit those photographs, a complete set of photographs of all the Dead Sea Scrolls, in approximately 8 libraries throughout the world. So there will be 8 places in the world where there will be a complete set of the Dead Sea Scrolls. No one knew about this. Only the photographer, presumably, and the small team of scholars who decided to do this. No one else knew about this. But there are 8 libraries in the world that had a complete set of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But they were, and when they signed the agreement that they would get a set of the Dead Sea Scrolls, they had to sign. They would never reveal that they had a set of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This was to be revealed only in case Jerusalem should be bombed, the Dead Sea Scrolls would be destroyed. Somewhere in the world, 8 other places, that would be the time they could all announce that they have photographs of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Herschel Shanks didn't know about this. Nobody knew about this. But Herschel Shanks was fighting this war and not winning it. So it's a long story, but I'm going to make it short. One of the libraries that got a copy of this was called the Huntington Library in California. They got one of the, they had one of the 8 copies of all the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the librarian of that library said, anybody who wants to can come to my library and look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, and anybody who wants to can have photographs from my photographs of the Dead Sea Scrolls. He broke the ice. He announced to the whole world that this was a scandal, that only 8 volumes had been published, and he will now make available to anybody who wants them. Anybody can come to his library and look at them, and if they're a scholar with scholarly credentials, they can order copies from him. No problem. With that, when he did that, that was the end of the story. Well, the Israeli government went crazy. The Israeli authorities sued and so on, and part of the whole process, as they say in Yiddish, gonish geholfen. This library and made up its mind, this librarian, and he made these scrolls. Yeah, it was taken from Claremont. So I said I didn't want to get into the whole story. One of the 8 libraries that was assigned the copy lost it, gave it over to the Huntington Library. It's a whole long story. And then the librarian of Huntington, who just died approximately a week or so ago, and there was a very final obituary on him in the New York Times. Anyway, once he did that, then Herschel Shanks didn't waste much time. Why should you have to go to California to get a picture of the scrolls? So Herschel Shanks immediately got a hold of a complete set of the photographs through Huntington and published them very quickly in these 2 massive volumes. These are the Dead Sea Scrolls. Many of these have never been published. No one's ever published thousands of fragments, as you can see. And I'm going to pick. This is virtually everything. Virtually everything. It's all here. Virtually everything. There are a few things that are not here, but virtually everything. And everything that's important is in here. All right? So if you think there's any reference to Oto Aish in the Dead Sea Scrolls, all you have to do is read through these 2 volumes, and you'll find yourself. Vast amount of material in these volumes has not been published critically, that is, not been published with commentary. So now you can read all the Dead Sea Scrolls on your own. Well, once Herschel Shanks did that, that was certainly the end of the story, and the Israeli government gave up. The Israeli authorities said, it's no use. They reassigned all the scrolls. They created a new team. Emanuel Tov is the head of the team. He's a good friend of mine. And many of the scrolls were assigned to Jews. And now the Dead Sea Scrolls are coming out at a very good pace. I'd almost say approximately 2 green volumes a year. Superb pace, and it's going to be even more than that, 3 or 4 a year since 1990. So we have lots of volumes. There are over 10 volumes in print already, and many more will appear in the next few years. And the rule now is, if you don't publish the scroll something like within 5 years of the day you get it, it will be taken away from you. So they're very strict now, and they're actually
there. The reason they really weren't published was not because they were anti-Semitic at all, but just because they really didn't understand how to interpret them properly.
Well, neither of those, or a little of those, and more. I'll give you a third option, which you didn't, okay?
Professor Goitein,
so you'll hear Professor Goitein. used to be, he's not alive anymore. He was at the Hebrew University. Yes. Someone else published, but it was published and available. Professor Goitein left Hebrew University, went to University of Pennsylvania, and then he left. And then he went to Princeton. Well, it was a good idea, but after him, Professor Goshen Gutstein and others arranged for its publication, and it is available right now if you're interested. Of the Keter, the Aleppo Codex. Okay, but that's separate from. We'll soon see how that's important and relates to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Yes. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Wide variety of techniques. I'm not sure which ones you have in mind, but also enhancing the scrolls. Where you can't read a scroll and so on, they're absolutely using computers with great success. Yes, thanks. Okay. Now I'm going to just very quickly give you the third up, present the pros and cons of the two sides. These scrolls are very difficult to read and understand. Even more difficult, you have to reconstruct the text. There are thousands of fragments. It's like a crossword puzzle. You have to have all these thousands of fragments in front of you. You can't just publish your little column that you were assigned. Your first task is to find the rest of the scroll. Well, how do you find the rest of the scroll? You have thousands of fragments. Look at these pictures when I pass them around. Thousands of fragments in all shaped differently with little Hebrew letters on them. A crossword puzzle, and you have to put these together. Well, it's a tremendous amount of work. You can't publish these scrolls in 1 minute. And they were given to very great scholars who did fairly well. So on the one hand, they really can't be published properly immediately. That was the argument of the scholars. And the scholars said, once we're putting in years, 5 years, 6 years of our life to publish a major scroll with a commentary, we did all the crossword puzzle, we did the hard work. You're going to publish a photograph now of the scroll and make it available to everybody, so who's going to be interested in our book? All our work is for nothing. Now everybody else is going to start doing the work on their own. Not fair. So the scholars had an argument, and I'm going to support it in a minute from other evidence. What Shanks said was, publish photographs. These are ancient documents. The whole world is interested in these documents. We want to know what Tanakh looked like. We want to know whether there's any reference to Christianity in these texts. Is there a New Testament anywhere? A verse from the New Testament anywhere in these scrolls? We're waiting and waiting and waiting. 40 years, you published 8 volumes. You want to publish a great commentary? Go right ahead. Take all the time you want. We don't have to wait around 40 years to see a photograph of the scrolls. We want photographs, that's all. Publish the scrolls unscrambled. Scrambled, however you want them, publish them. Well, we want the photographs of everything you discovered. You want to publish the greatest book ever on whatever scroll you want, that's your privilege. But let the rest of the world see the scrolls. That's what Shanks said. So this was the argument. The scholars answered Shanks and said, if we do that, first of all, there are always these people who work quickly who are going to publish commentaries before we ever finish our work, so we lose all our credit. And second of all, you're going to have shoddy scholarship. Every fool in the world is going to publish a commentary on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Which is what happened. Not every fool, but many fools. So, just to give you a sample of what goes on. So here's a book called The Dead... This was right after all the scrolls were published. The Dead Sea Scrolls, Deception, Why a Handful of Religious Scholars Conspire to Suppress the Revolutionary Contents of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You see? Then you read this book and it's unbelievable. I can't begin to tell you how many misstatements of fact there are on almost every page. So you see there was a third option. Why the scholars couldn't publish these scrolls right away? It's not simply they were incompetent. Some of them were somewhat incompetent. But indeed the scrolls were very difficult to publish. But these scrolls just are not amenable to quick publication. It really requires scholarship. Otherwise you get all this nonsense. And this book goes on to say that the Vatican got involved and how the Vatican tried to prevent these scrolls. Why did these Christian scholars not publish for 40 years the Dead Sea Scrolls? Because they're Christians. Because many of them were Roman Catholics. They took orders from the Vatican. The Vatican said, don't you dare publish these scrolls. It'll prove Christianity is wrong. You see. Does it? No. We don't need the Dead Sea Scrolls for that. All right.
About 18 months ago,
Not a, be fair. The Dead Sea Scrolls, I just want to answer. The Dead Sea Scrolls shed a tremendous amount of light on early Christianity and on early Judaism. Tremendous amount of light. We can better understand how Christianity grew out of Judaism through the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we'll have some samples perhaps later. Rightly so. All right. Maybe I'll to defend Manfred Lehmann, who's a good friend of mine. Manfred Lehmann believes strongly, and he's right in certain sense, but believes very strongly that all the great Hebrew manuscripts that are in libraries throughout the world, especially in the Vatican, belong to the Jews. Why does the Vatican have copies of all the Rishonim, the Mordechai, and the Rambam, and so on? Why does the Bodleian Library have? This was all Jewish material. Much of it was taken from Jews by force. So Manfred Lehmann's argument is anything that belonged to Jews should go back to the Jews. And therefore, anyone who would write a book like this, which exposes the establishment, which says that the scrolls are being hidden away, especially at this time, most of them were in the hands of Christian scholars, that's part of his shita, bring it forward. Sort of supported his position. But that book, this book is indefensible, and don't waste your time reading it. Far better than that book, but still, typical sample of the shoddiness that happens when you try to publish these scrolls immediately, is a second book called The Dead Sea Scrolls Uncovered, the first complete translation and interpretation of 50 key documents withheld for over 35 years. Now, this is a very important book in the sense that it publishes many of the documents that had not been seen before based on the photographs, those two volumes that I passed around. This is a more serious book, but full of errors. And some of these, it says the first complete translation of over 50 key documents. Many of these so-called 50 key documents were published long ago. These people didn't even know that they were already published by scholars available in the standard journals. And this was done by a scholar named Eisenman. And on the back cover, it has a haskama, it has a letter of approbation from Michael Bangent and Richard Lay, the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls Deception. So, you see how this works if you want to look at this. Probably. Okay. All right.
Quid pro quo.
Let's look at some Dead Sea Scrolls. And first, the significance of the scrolls. And while we look at them, I'll pass these around. While I describe the significance, I'll take some and pass them around. Until 1947, the oldest extant copy of a complete Sefer Torah, the oldest Sefer Torah in the world, was from the 12th century. Oldest complete Torah, 12th century. We actually have a Sefer Torah written by the Ran, which brings us to the 13th century. But the oldest complete Torah in the world was from the 12th century. The oldest Hebrew manuscripts of Tanakh, were approximately from the 10th century. That includes the Keter, approximately from the 10th century. We have no copies of Tanakh, we had no copies before the 10th century. Start with the Torah, which presumably belongs to Moshe Rabbeinu, which gets you back to, who knows, 1500 or so B.C. From 1500 B.C. until the year 900 A.D., or 900 of the Common Era, no copies of Tanakh. Unbelievable. No Hebrew copies. So these manuscripts of Tanakh, these are not Sifrei Torah, but these are handwritten copies of Tanakh with nikud, with vocalization, from which you copy and preserve the text of Tanakh, all of Tanakh, not just the Torah. Approximately the 7th century of the Common Era, then post-Talmudic. Nikud and cantillation go together, both together. There's no nikud and no cantillation anywhere in the Talmud, unknown in the Talmud. Okay? The oldest copies of Tanakh were in Yerushalayim, the Keter coming from Aleppo to Yerushalayim, and in Leningrad. I think it's St. Petersburg again these days. Okay. Now, while there were no older copies of Tanakh in Hebrew, there were older witnesses to Tanakh in Greek. There's a Greek translation of Tanakh, which goes back early period, called the Septuagint, Targum HaShivim, the Septuagint, and there are Greek manuscripts of Tanakh, beautiful manuscripts, in Oxford, in London, in the British Museum, and these manuscripts date back to the 3rd and 4th century. And if you've been reading newspapers, you know that they found, the claim is that they found at Oxford even a Greek copy of one book of the New Testament from the year 50, which is very early for the New Testament. But in any event, with regards to the whole Tanakh, copies exist only from the 3rd and 4th century, meaning the time of the Amoraim. Those are the oldest Greek copies. Now, Bible scholars who studied Tanakh for centuries, from the medieval period on, there was always a debate, a running debate between Jews and Christians. The Christians, I take it you're all well aware that the Greek Bibles differ from the Hebrew Bibles. Not the same. Text is different. Sometimes they're very important differences have to do with Christianity. So, Alma, right, is translated by the Greek as version, but we read it in Hebrew, Alma. What did we say? What did our, in all the debates, what did our forefathers say when they heard this argument from the Christians? We have 9th century, 10th century. Better, we had a better, close, related to that. What we said was, we have the original language. Very nice, you have a Greek text, but your Greek text is a translation. We have it, you admit it was written in Hebrew. We have the original language.
They didn't know how to translate.
That's right. That's what we said. This argument continued until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this is one of the really significant benefits of having these Dead Sea Scrolls. Because when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, for the first time, we had copies of Tanakh in Hebrew, not from the year 900 or 1000 A.D. We had copies now that were 2,000 years old. We have copies from 300 B.C., of some Svarim of Tanakh, 300 B.C., some of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Yeah, I'll talk about it. And by the way, this week, it was announced on the, those of you who read your email, if you're on Udios or some other groups, new radiocarbon tests were just made this week on the Dead Sea Scrolls in the University of Arizona, and they prove once again the antiquity of the scrolls, that all the Dead Sea Scrolls are pre-Christian. They're pre the first century. They're all 35, 40, 200, 300 B.C. So there can't be any references to Oto Ha'ish in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Oto Ha'ish was born after the Dead Sea Scrolls were written. All right. Now, to be all in light of the comment that was just made, and to be fair, what they found in the Hebrew texts of the Bible published among the Dead Sea Scrolls was that many of the Dead Sea copies of Tanakh are virtually in agreement with our Masoretic texts. So it turns out that the Keter and the Balei HaMesorah, who preserved the Keter, did a marvelous job. Absolutely. They did a very good job. They preserved the text as they received it, and that text is very close, in many places almost exact, and indeed exact, with copies of various biblical manuscripts found among the Dead Sea Scrolls from 100 to 200 B.C. No question about it. Especially one of the two famous scrolls of Yeshayahu that were discovered. On the other hand, other Hebrew texts of the Dead Sea Scrolls that were discovered are exactly the equivalent of the Greek translations. The Greek translations are accurate, but they're not translations of the Masoretic texts. They're translations of a variant Hebrew text of Tanakh, and we now have it. Well, I assume I know from Talmud. In other words, the Talmud cites biblical verses as they're in the Masoretic text. So, and not like, so I know. Okay. Now, Yeah, sure, yeah. Now, so instead of fighting over whether the Septuagint or the Masoretic text is the better preserved text of the Bible, modern scholars now are fighting over the two ancient Hebrew texts of Tanakh. Which of these two different versions of Tanakh in Hebrew is the original one written by the Navi himself in each case, as the case may be? And thank God scholars still have what to debate about, because we also have to make a living. They have more than one copy. As early as 300 or 200 BC. See? In other words, it was already one book, when these scrolls were written. You can't prove what happened 500 or 600 BC. Someday we'll make another archaeological discovery. Right now, this is as far back as they can get. Sorry? Ben? Where? What do you have in mind? It depends where. It depends. Yes, exactly what that would be, yes. Among the differences. All right, let's look at the first page. Give you a good sample of what I'm talking about. You have the first page, so here you have a Dead Sea Scroll in front of you, a nice copy. You all know this by heart. This is Ashrei, okay? Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha. Now, Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha, of course, as you know, the first two verses of Ashrei come from a different part of Tehillim. But then you have Psalm 145. After the two verses beginning Ashrei, it begins, we say, what do we say? Tehillah le David. What does this say? Tehillah le David. So you already see the interesting things we find in... Now, if you keep reading this, first of all, you'll notice in the first line, the Shem Hashem is written in Old Hebrew. That's Old Hebrew. Tav Ivri. So this is a scroll. There are some scrolls written in Old Hebrew, others in good Rabbinic Hebrew, Ketav Ashuri, and some have a mixture. Here, whenever you have the Shem Hashem is in Old Hebrew. So you have Tefillah LeDavid, Arom Micha Hashem, Lokai HaMelech, etc. And at the end of every verse, look immediately the second line, you'll see Baruch Hashem, uBaruch Shebo, LeOlam VaEd. See it? Middle of the second line. Let me start from the beginning. Tefillah leDavid, Arom Micha Hashem, Elokai HaMelech. Line 2. Vavarechecha Shimcha LeOlam VaEd. That's the end of the first verse. Now, at the end of each verse, you have a hymn. The Kahal, presumably the Kehillah, answers Baruch Hashem, Baruch Shemo, LeOlam VaEd. Okay? And then it continues through. Now, you all know that Ashrei follows the alphabet. What's missing in Ashrei? What letter is missing? Nun is missing. Well, start from the second paragraph. Now you'll see the Nun. You see Baruch Shemo LeOlam VaEd? That's the end of the bracha of the Kal after each line. Now starts Mem. What does it say? Malchutcha, Malchut Kol Olamim, Umimshalcha B'chol Davado, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Shemo LeOlam VaEd. Ne'eman Elokim Bidvarav, Bichasid B'chol Ma'asav. Next line, Somei Hashem L'chol. They have the Nun. They have the moon. Very nice. Okay, now the spellings that are different, right? But this is very interesting. This is wonderful. And, of course, it raises the issue, and we're not going to solve it here, whether this nun is original and dropped out for some reason, Chazal didn't include it, or whether because the nun was missing, they invented a pasuk and put the nun in. Because notice, the end of the nun, it says, Chasid, what does it say? The Chasid B'chol Masav. That sound familiar? That's later in Ashrei. You have it again. So it's maybe an artificial pasuk. This is something that modern scholars are debating, and they write books and articles and make a living discussing such matters. Okay. Yes, this is part. This comes from a Tehillim scroll. They had different kinds of Tehillim scrolls, but I don't have the time now to go into detail. Okay, let's go to passage 2, page 2, passage 2. Among the Dead Sea Scrolls were found many pairs of tefillin. Archaeologists excavated, and they found tefillin. Tefillin Shel Rosh and tefillin Shel Yad, which is very interesting, because there are many different shitot in the Parashiyot, what the order of the Parashiyot is. In case you're interested, by the way, they found Rashi's tefillin and Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin. They found both in one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's an old machloket. Yes, that's a famous... The famous Rambam Kesef Mishnah brings that in his in Hilchot Tefillin. That's right. You're absolutely right. What? I didn't count them, but both are represented. Both are represented. But I'll come to that. All right. The Sifrei. Yes, go ahead. First, because we have many copies of Tehillim from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they're different. You just have one in front of you now, right? So you're thinking this is the original. There are 20 different Tehillim from... We have different texts of Tehillim from the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're not the same. So which one is the original? It's a good question, but we have 20 different copies from the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it's not at all clear. That's right. It's not at all. Moreover, once you see Baruch Hashem, you see already that this is not just what the Mechaber wrote. This is already used in his. It sounds like it was used in a synagogue service. This comes from a siddur. That's right. It's a very good question, and much has been written about it. And it depends upon which Psalm scroll of the Dead Sea Scrolls you're talking about. Right? Some are clearly books of Psalms. Some may be what are called hymn books, books that were used in a service for singing songs at various times. We'll come to it in a minute. They have extra mizmorim, right? And some of them we knew before from the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. All right, passage 2 on top of page 2. This is a chazal, this is a sifrei, a very important passage, where parasha from Kriyat Shema is commented upon, and you know, it says, Ukshartam, Yoto Yadcha, etc. Look at the last line. What does it say? Ukshartam, Elu Bikshira, Ve'ein Aseret Hadibrot Bikshira. You should put the four parashiyot, and you know the four parashiyot come from Sefer Shmot and Sefer Dvarim. There are four parashiyot talking about Tefillin and so on, or Yitziat Mitzrayim, and these four parashiyot, V'haya, Ki Yiviyacha, etc. That's what's written on the Tefillin, both Shel Rosh and Shel Yad. They have the same parashiyot. In the Rosh, they're in four separate compartments. In the Yad, the four parashiyot are written on one scroll. But look what it says here. Chazal said, Elu Bikshira, V'ein Eser Hadibrot Bikshira. So you put the four parashiyot that we all know about in Tefillin, but you don't put the Ten Commandments in Tefillin. This, by the way, this occurs nowhere else in all of rabbinic literature. This is not in Bavli, not in Yerushalmi. Nowhere is a sugya on Tefillin in the Sechet Menachot. No one ever imagined that Aseret HaDibrot would be in Tefillin. It looked very strange, right? Sifrei, presumably edited by Rav Shimon Yochai. I have here Tefillin from Qumran, Dead Sea Scrolls, and you'll have here, I'll pass it around, the Parashiyot, the original Tefillin, and with here they're spelled out in modern Hebrew, written out, and here are the parashiyot of Tefillin, and I'm going to read to you. Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim. What's that? Aseret HaDibrot. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, they had the Ten Commandments in the Tefillin. When Chazal, they had also the four parashiyot. They had another parasha. They had five parashiyot. And here's Chazal telling us, they knew full well, don't put in Aseret HaDibrot. He'll tell me. You'll take a look. Okay. Yes, it is Einachinami. Chazal ruled that you should. In the temple, it was absolutely included in the services, and Chazal would not allow it in the Sidur. Absolutely. Now, related to this, I have a Mishnah here, Mishnayot Sanhedrin. Mishnah Sanhedrin 11:3. Mishnah reads as follows. The Mishnah is defining Zaken Mamre, the halakha of the rebellious elder. What kind of halakha does a rebellious elder have to rule in order to be called a rebellious elder? There's a famous rabbi here in America who was involved in a tremendous halachic dispute whether you can do chalitza al yedei shliach. Famous rabbi, lived right here in Brooklyn. And this is 90 years ago. And this rabbi had a dispute with the Rogachev Gaon, Rav Yosef Rosen in Dvinsk. And they wrote letters back and forth. And the rabbi here was for chalitza al yedei shliach. He's a great rabbi, a great Talmudist. And there's a tshuva of Rav Yosef Rosen in Dvinsk, and the tshuva says as follows. I would call you Rabbi so-and-so in America, a Zaken Mamre, but you're not a big enough Talmid Chacham. All right. So here in Mishnah 11.3 is a Mishnah's definition. Mishnah says, Chome b'divrei sofrim b'divrei Torah, ha'omer ein tfilin kidei la'avor al divrei Torah patur. A rabbi who rules that there's no such thing as tfilin, he's not a Zaken Mamre. That's the halacha. Mishnah. Chamesh totafot. You see, to say that there's no tefillin when everybody knows that there is tefillin, and v'hayu l'totafot b'ninecha, so it's just foolish. It's not a bad tzarek, it's foolish. But chamesh totafot, Mishnah. But if you say that there are five totafot, l'hosif al divrei sofrim chayav. If you say there are five totafot, then you're a zakei mamre. Five totafot? Where's five totafot? Five parashiyot in tefillin. Five parashiyot in tefillin. Where are five parashiyot in tefillin? The Dead Sea Scrolls. They have the four parashiyot with the Aseret HaDibrot. They knew what they were talking about. One more sample and we're done for today. Excuse me? No, no. Some have it and some don't. Some have it and some don't. I'm not sure. They had five parashiyot. Whether they had five batim is not clear. Yeah, the pictures here look like four batim. That's right. That's right.
They didn't have five batim.
Yes, the batim too. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So far, yes, of course, absolutely. All right. Okay. Now in Yana de Yoma, we're going to talk about today. If you take a look on page 3, let's see, I'm sorry, bottom of page 2, passage 3, bottom of page 2. We are now in Sfirat HaOmer, and this is a Mishnah about the Korban HaOmer, the time of the Beit HaMikdash. They used to bring a sacrifice called the Omer sacrifice when they cut the Omer, which is at the beginning of the, what we count Sfira. According to the Torah says, what does the Torah say? Mimacharat on Shabbat. And what did the rabbi say Shabbat means? First day of Pesach. So Motzei, first day of Pesach. They used to reap the Omer and bring a sacrifice. Now, so the Mishnah, look at the Mishnah, let's say four lines down. Kevan shechashecha, omer lehem ba shemesh. You wait for the first day of Pesach to end. As soon as it gets dark, the leader says, "Did the sun go down?" Omrin hein. Ba shemesh. Omrin hein. Magalzo. Is this a scythe? I'm going to reap the omer. I'm going to cut the omer now. They say yes. Kupa. Is this a basket? Yes. And then you go ahead and you cut the omer. Right after the first day of Yom Tov is over, Motzei Pesach. Bishabbat. Omer lahem, Shabbat zo? What do you mean by Shabbat? What does Shabbat mean? If the first day of Pesach fell on Friday. And so what is Motzei Pesach? First day of Pesach. What night is it? Friday night, which we call Shabbat, Leil Shabbat. What if it's Shabbat? What if the first day of Pesach is Friday? And now it's Motzei Friday? And now it's Leil Shabbat? Omer lahem, Shabbat zo? The leader in the Beit HaMikdash says, is it Shabbat? Omrim Hein. You sure it's Shabbat? Omrim Hein. Ektsor Shuraim. Du Ktsira on Shabbat? Ktsor. Yes, indeed. That's the din. The halacha is that should Pesach fall on Friday and Motzei Pesach is Friday night, you cut the wheat on Friday night, even though Ktzira is Asur on Shabbat, but not... What? Oh, that's now, not then. No. Okay? Vehemenim loksor, shlosha pamin kol davar v'davar. Three times. So the Mishnah asks, kol kach lama, how come they had to stutter in the Beit HaMikdash? Why? Three times they had to repeat each time. Shabbatzo, Shabbatzo, Magalzo, Magalzo, Kupazo, Kupazo, etc. Kol kach lama, mipnei habaitosim. Because there was a group of Jews called Bethusians, Baitusim. Shehayu Omrim, they used to say, Ein Tzirat Omer Motzei Yom Tov. That's the Mishnah. They said that you do not cut the grain on Motzei Yom Tov. Oh, it doesn't say because of Shabbat. Now, my whole life when I've been reading this Mishnah, I never could figure it out. What is this last line? Shayu Omrim Ein Tzirat Omer B'Motzei Yom Tov. What do you mean Ein Tzirat Omer B'Motzei Yom Tov? Why not? And supposing Pesach falls on Sunday, or Monday, or Tuesday, whatever day you like. So Macharat Shabbat means you do it the night after Pesach. So it's the only reason they didn't want to do it this time was why? Because it was Shabbat. Because Motzei Yom Tov happened to be Shabbat. That's why they refused to do it. But what is the look at the words? What do the words say? Shehayu Omrim Ein Ktzirat HaOmer B'Motzei Yom Tov. What do you mean? They have nothing against Ktzirat HaOmer B'Motzei Yom Tov. They're only against Ktzirat HaOmer B'Motzei Yom Tov when it happens to be Leil Shabbat. But that's not what the Mishnah says. Very strange Mishnah. And even stranger, I looked in Perushim on Mishnayot. This was such an obvious question to me to see. I couldn't find, for a long time, I couldn't find anybody who asks, until Baruch Hashem. After years of searching, I found a Perush on Mishnayot. And it's always a good method. If you have a question on Tanakh, it's now 1995. It's impossible that all the famous Gedolim and Rabbanim didn't think of whatever your question was. Somebody should have thought of it, unless there's something wrong with your question. But if you have a good question, someone somewhere should have thought of it. Unless, again, it could be you have archaeological material or some new material that no one knew about, but if you're just dealing with the same text that everybody else dealt with, there's no reason why the great minds of the past shouldn't have thought of it. So sure enough, there's a Perush on Mishnayot called Kol Sofer, on the Sechet Menachot. This is a Mishnah Menachot by Rabbi Chaim Sofer. And beautifully, he says as follows. I'm just going to read his language. Bar Anochi Mehavin Shekatav B'Lashon Shlila Shabaitusim Omrim Ein Ktzirat HaOmer B'Motzei Yom Tov. V'lo katav shehayu omrim ktzirat haomer b'motzei Shabbat Breishit. We know what the Baitusim wanted. We have lots of sugyot in the Talmud. The Baitusim said mimacharat Shabbat means what? Shabbat Breishit. Mimacharat Shabbat means Saturday. That you bring the omer on the day after Saturday, which means when? Sunday, or Saturday night and Sunday. That's what they held. Therefore, when Pesach falls on Friday, and Motzei Pesach is Leil Shabbat, that's not Mocharat HaShabbat. They said Mocharat HaShabbat always means Saturday night or Sunday. Shabbat means Shabbat Breishit, Shabbat Saturday, the seventh day of the week, not first day of Pesach. Shabbat doesn't mean... That was what the Baitusim said. And he asked the question, what kind of language is this? If you asked me, what I would have liked here would be Kol Kach Lama B'Nei HaBaitusim Sheyomrim Ein Tzirat HaOmer Ela B'Motzei Shabbat. Or Ela B'Yom Rishon. Or Ela B'Mocharat HaShabbat. What do you mean B'Motzei Yom Tov? Nothing wrong with Ksira B'Motzei Yom Tov. Now take a look at the next page. Dead Sea Scrolls. Now this is in one of the... scroll. This is called one of the Dead Sea Psalm scrolls. We have this beautiful passage. It's in Hebrew on top, an English translation on bottom. Vayhi David ben Yishai Chacham, etc. Vayichtov Tehillim. Look at the third line in the Hebrew or the translation. This is amazing. How many Tehillim did David write? Shloshet Alafim B'Sheish Meot. 3,600. So it's not surprising that we found new Tehillim among the Dead Sea scrolls. ושיר ושורר לפני המזבח עולת התמיד לכל יום ויום לכל ימי השנה ארבעה ושישים ושלוש מאות. He wrote 364 songs, one for every olat ha-tamid, one for every olah, or for each day for the olat ha-tamid, for every day of the year. How many days? How many songs and how many days? 364. How many days are there in our calendar, the Jewish? 354. The Jewish calendar, our calendar, has 6 months of 29 days and 6 months of 30 days. So 6 times 29 plus 6 times 30, 354 days. That's what a Jewish calendar looks like. But they had 364 days. This is a Dead Sea sect. But now we know about the Luach. They had 364 days. Now, it turns out we know, we have their calendar, every month with 30 days, all months with 30 days, and every season had an extra day, so 364 altogether. Now, what's the difference between having a calendar of 364 days and having a calendar of 354 days? Who said it? Exactly, precisely. We have 354 days. Can you divide 7 into 354? Can't do it. That's why in the Jewish calendar, every year the holidays come out on a different day. It doesn't break into weeks. But 364-day calendar, divisible by 7? Absolutely, 52 weeks. Every holiday falls on the same day every year. It never changes in the Dead Sea sect. Every holiday falls on the same day every year. Now, I'm going to save you some time. We know for the Dead Sea sect, we have their calendar, that Pesach always fell on Wednesday. First day of Pesach was always Wednesday. Never changes. Every year it's on Wednesday. Yom Rivi. Seventh day of Pesach, the following Tuesday. And then there's a Shabbat after Pesach, and they bring the Korban HaOmer, Mimocharat HaShabbat, on the Sunday after the first Shabbat after Pesach. And then they count 50 days. So what happens after 50 days? Shavuot. But they start counting a week after Pesach. Shavuot in this calendar, in their calendar, always comes in the third month, Sivan, on the 15th day of the month. As it says in the book of Jubilees, Sefer HaYovel. Okay. Excuse me? That's how they... Now, what I want to explain is the following. For the Dead Sea sect, for this group, for the Dead Sea sect, it's very clear that Mimocharat HaShabbat was always like Shabbat Bereshit, exactly like Chazal say, only it's Shabbat Bereshit after Pesach. It has nothing to do with Pesach. It's the first Shabbat after the last Tuesday of Pesach. It's the Shabbat after Pesach. Now go back in that Mishnah. Here's the Mishnah here. Shayum v'Baitusim, and we don't know who the Baitusim were. And the Baitusim may be. Maybe. Our Dead Sea sect. But anyway, the Baitusim say, Ein Ksirata Omer B'motzei Yom Tov. There's never Ksirata Omer B'motzei Yom Tov. Ksirata Omer is always after Pesach. It has nothing to do with Pesach. Exactly as the Lashon here. It's Pesach. Yom Tov is the name for Pesach here. It's not Pesach. It has nothing to do with Pesach. That's right. Okay. The Karaites have what? Yes, Mocharat Shabbat meaning Sunday, yes, but not the Shabbat after. And now, one more little perush, since we're on it. You, in that same paragraph on page 3, if you keep reading, it then says that they brought Lukorban Roshei Chodoshim Lechol Yemei Amoadot Leyom HaKippurim Shloshim Shir. And David HaMelech wrote 30 songs for the Korbanot of Rosh Chodesh and all the festivals, and Yom Kippur. 30 songs. All right, you do the mathematics. If there are 7 days of Pesach, there's 1 day of Shavuot. What you really need in front of you now is the Parashat HaMoadim in Sefer Vayikra. If you have that in front of you, you'll see that Pesach has... Pesach has 7 days, Shavuot has 1 day, Sukkot has 7 days plus Shmini Atzeret, 8. 1 day Yom Kippur. How many days do you have? No, Rosh Hashanah, you'll see, is going to be Rosh Chodesh. He says that you have, for all the Rosh Chodeshim. So how many Rosh Chodeshim are there? 12. Add them up, it's 29. Where do you get 30? But if you have a Chumash, and you open up the Parashat HaMoadim, Vayikra, Perek Chav Gimel, and you read it as they read it. And you start reading and you count from Pesach, you'll see there are 7 days. And what comes after Pesach? A new paragraph. And it says, David ben Yisrael, Matalim Kedavoy La'aretz, Uksartem et Tzira, Veivetem et Omer. There's a Korban HaOmer. It's a separate paragraph. On one day, you bring Korban HaOmer. That's another Korban. And another Shir. That's Shir number 30. This is a separate festival. Okay. What I'm really getting at is that if you read the Dead Sea Scrolls, you get tremendous insights into Chazal, and there's much more that I could possibly say here, but at least we had enough samples. I don't want to keep you here all night. I would say, in sum, the Dead Sea Scrolls are without question the most momentous discovery, archaeological discovery, of this century. They shed light on the biblical text, on the development of Hebrew and Aramaic, and I didn't even talk about that. There are many words now that we have a better sense of what they mean, seeing how they appear in these scrolls, on the history of Judaism, the history of Christianity, on the what's called the intertestamental period, and indeed on the history of Halakha. And so we need to listen to these texts, to learn from them whatever secrets they have about our wondrous past. I want to close, and I may have said this once. I remember I had a small class here with a group of you. I don't know, one or two of you may have been in it. We learned Tanakh at the time. But there's a beautiful Devar Torah that relates to archaeology, so I'd like to mention that at this point. There's a verse in Mishle. I'll read it and translate it. Im tivakshena chakasef v'chamat monim tachtesena oz tavin yirat Hashem v'dat Elokim timtza. Beautiful pasuk. If you seek wisdom like silver, and search for it as you would for buried treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and discover the knowledge of God. Many of the commentators on this verse in Mishle ask, why did the author add the words v'chamat monim tachpesen? It says, im tivakshena chakasa. You search for it like silver. We would all search for silver with great energy. What does he have to ask? V'chamat monim tachtesena. And you're going to search for it as you would for buried treasure. What does that add? And one of the Farshim, the Netziv, said as follows. There are those people who maintain mistakenly that supposing you're studying Torah for many hours, many days and many years, you're studying Torah and you get caught up in a problem. You come to a Tosafot, a passage, you can't figure it out. You come to a Pasuk in Tanakh and you don't know what it means. Can't figure it out. You spend hours on it and you still can't figure it out. There are those who would claim, mistakenly, says the Netziv, that you haven't fulfilled your obligation of study of Torah. Talmud, you spent any hours and the He'la Cheres Piyado. You came up with nothing. To counter such a mistaken view, the verse in Proverbs says that you should search for wisdom not only as you would for silver, but as you would for buried treasure. And the Netziv said as follows. Supposing you have a map, you know there's buried treasure on an island. You have a map. And there's somewhere on the island there's treasure buried. You start excavating and you're digging and digging and you find nothing. You find nothing. You've hardly wasted your time, because now you know where not to dig and where to start digging anew. So too said the Netziv with regard to Torah. If you get caught up in a problem and you can't resolve it, it's hardly a waste of time. Ultimately, one finds his or her way. Im tivakshenu chakaseh v'chamat monim tachtesenu, if you will search for it as you would for buried treasure with a map, oz tavin yirat Hashem, then you will reach the fear of the Lord, you will understand the fear of the Lord, v'dat Elokim timtza, and you will discover the knowledge of God. Thank you very much.